This is the DTV Digest, the podcast that brings you news and reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema. And now, here's your host, Mike Parkin.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the DTV Digest, the podcast which brings you reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema and instead went straight to DVD, Blu-ray, or streaming media. I'm your host, Mike Parkin, and joining me this week is Richard Hawes.
Hello, everyone.
Stephen Lockridge.
Hello.
And our special guest is Jessica Scott. Welcome, Hello. Jessica.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Jessica, why don't you tell our listeners a little about yourself and why you're here?
Okay. Well, my name is Jessica Scott. I'm a freelance film writer. I mostly cover horror, but I love all genres. You can find me on Twitter, usually at We Who Walk Here. I write for Film Cred, Nightmarish Conjurings, Ghouls Magazine, and I have a horror comics column at Daily Grindhouse. You can find all my film writing and other things, mainly talking about horror, at We Who Walk Here on Twitter.
What sort of got you into the sort of horror genre, Jessica?
Honestly, I don't remember a time that I wasn't into horror. Growing up, I was always drawn to the spooky things, the creepy things. I think that my first horror movie was Poltergeist when I was maybe 5 or 6. You hid behind the couch and watched it while my parents watched it and kind of got hooked on it from there, and just kept seeking out more and more horror and creepier things that were perhaps not age appropriate for me, but I still enjoyed them.
Yeah, I think we sort of all grew up in what was called the video nasty era in England, and which I think sort of just reinforced the whole genre for us, really. You know, it made it that much more enticing, the fact that it was sort of a bit more sort of taboo, and you know, people are actually trying to stop you from watching stuff.
Exactly. Yeah, it's the horror section of the video store for me was kind of, you know, I didn't have a local video store that had an adult section, you know, the stereotypical behind the beaded curtain area. But that was kind of the horror section for me, was the forbidden zone, where I would go and look at things that I wasn't allowed to watch yet, but I really wanted to. So I always had a running mental tally of the movies that I wanted to watch when I was old enough or sneaky enough to rent them.
Is Halloween the best holiday?
Oh my gosh, yeah. Halloween is the only holiday.
Of course it is. It's my birthday.
Is it? Oh. I didn't even know that. Well, my short-term memory has probably forgotten about it already. Okay. It's not quite as big a deal over here as it is in America, that's for sure. But it's catching on. The whole thing with like trick-or-treating and stuff is, you know, over the last decade has become more of a accepted tradition over here, I think. So yeah, it's getting that way.
Good.
Yeah, it's certainly getting that way. So Jessica is going to be
have fallen off here.
Yeah, I suppose. It's mostly the young sort of tens and under, I suppose, sort of get taken over their parents. Yeah. But anyway, so Jessica, you're going to be helping us review a couple of films tonight. Our short shot, which is Meet Jimmy, which we'll get onto shortly. And also, you've chosen our DTV throwback, which is Satan's Little Helper. So we're going to be talking about that a little later as well. Also on the show tonight, our main reviews are going to be I Blame Society, which is an interesting sort of indie gonzo kind of movie. Fear of Rain, which is Catherine Hegel's film, The Devil's Machine, which is a British period horror movie, Forget Everything and Run, which is a bit more sort of post-apocalyptic zombie kind of thing, and then For the Sake of Vicious, which I'm not going to talk about just yet. Okay, so without further ado, let's crack on. Our first review then is I Blame Society. When struggling filmmaker Gillian is told in jest by a close friend that she would make a perfect murderer, it sows the seed of an idea to use extreme lengths to force a breakup between her close friend Chase and his bitchy girlfriend Starlin. Gillian documents her progress with a view of turning it into a movie. Okay, so Steve, did you see this one?
Yes. Yeah.
So this is it's kind of like in a very sort of gonzo style, the way it's shot. How did you get on with this one?
Is that any better?
That's it.
There we go. It starts off with just an interview with this woman and this bloke, and starts getting a bit personal and, you know, nasty and catty about his partner, and then it throws to another interview where she gets complimented saying that she can be the perfect murderer and perform the perfect murder. And it just starts going wildly escalating from that point. And it's very meta, like I say, very gonzo. And, you know, the scene with the meeting with the producers and stuff like that. And then she finally goes over into actually killing people. It kind of reminded me of The Columnist that we watched a couple of weeks back, in a way. But obviously more in the gonzo style, more meta style in like that. And she's quite an annoying character in a way. I don't, obviously she's a murderer. I don't think she's supposed to be likable. But it just seemed to be more comic than horror in a way. You know, you got a little bit of gore in there, you know, when she's doing some killings and things like that. And then at the end, it goes a little bit over the top with some of the bloodletting. But apart from that, it was okay. It was enjoyable, but nice to see a different twist on it in a way. You know, you've seen certain things like man bites dog.
Yeah,
things like that. And but it was nice to see actual female take the lead in something like this as well. And obviously you've got a bit of Me Too in there as well, you know, with the sexist producers and stuff like that. But no, overall it's pretty good.
Rich, what do you make of I Blame Society?
Yeah, I liked it a lot as well. I mean, Man Bites Dog is the thing that immediately jumps to mind as soon as you start watching anything like this. There was also a good little British one called The Last Horror Movie, which Julian Richards' film from a few years ago, which had the concept of a killer being followed around. Whereas in this case, it starts like that, but then the cinematographer, you know, camera operator says she actually doesn't want to really be a part of it. So it's the subject is also the film. So it becomes a one person sort of production from that point, which adds a whole other element because she's wearing like silly cameras on her head and pausing to do setups and I just need to put a camera over there or sneakily doing it and setting them up or whatever. But yeah, it's a black comedy. It's satirical. Quite convincing for what it is. You know, it's not too outlandish. I mean, they go to points you like you can't believe she's doing it, but there is a sense of she's just, you know, she's not right. You know, she's not getting the distance. A bit like a film you're going to talk about later, Satan's Little Helper. You know, there's a disconnect between the severity of what is happening and the sort of, and the playfulness of it. So there's a feeling that I'm making a movie. You know, it's not real because she's making a movie. It's quite interesting. So yeah, it's the central character is the writer and director herself, played by Gillian Wallace-Horvath, and there's a whole, it's that whole, as Steve was saying, it's the meta thing of the film you're watching is the film she's making. So it's all structured quite cleverly. It's obviously been put together after it, you know, things have all happened, but it's not like a found footage. There's no sort of found footage angle to it. But apart from a bit where she kills someone and there's some obviously CGI fake blood, the rest of it came across really well. And I thought the conclusion, you know, the way they wrapped it up with the conclusion, I thought was very smart. It's a good, it's a good little movie. She acts completely inappropriately from the get-go. You know, it starts off with this really awkward interview where she's just talking to her friend and say, and starts, you know, revealing stuff that he's like, well, I didn't realize you were going to start talking about that. It's, you know, it's really awkward. And she's like, oh, that's okay. Well, it's just a film. It's just between them. Whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a film that she's going to see now. So
and the, yeah. Oh, yeah. And I don't want to, yeah, don't really want to say too much else because I think that would spoil it. But yeah, I'd recommend it.
Yeah. It's interesting what you're saying in that. It's like, you know, she's saying all this stuff to him, you know. And he's sort of saying, yeah, okay, but you're going to put it in your film. So either I have to tell her about it now, which is going to be really hurtful, or I'm going to have to keep it a secret, and then she's going to find out anyway.
Yeah, yeah. Later on.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, for God's sake, you know. But, yeah.
The thing is, she's not evil, though, is she? She's
not exactly.
She's acting in an evil way, but not evilly. You know, she's too... naive, I guess is the more appropriate word for it.
Well, I mean, the funny thing about like the suicide notes, and she's going, "Oh, this is all, you know, part of my MO and all the rest of it, and make it all look like suicide." And the police are going, "Well, clearly, all these suicide notes are written by the same person."
Yeah.
So there's one thing.
But at the same time, everyone's sort of going, "Yeah, but it's obviously suicide because the suicide note, you know, is exactly how that person sounds, you know, and the sort of stuff they were actually dealing with." So. You know, it's interesting. Yeah, it's like the police aren't convinced, but the you know, close friends and family are.
So here's an interesting filmmaking angle that they've done with it: is that there's a voiceover to read the suicide notes, but it's not her reading them.
No,
it's somebody else. So she kills someone, like a man, and then it's a man's voiceover reading the suicide note, and I'm sort of coming out of the film thinking, well, how's that possible? But then I think, if I'm right, that she then starts talking to someone who I guess she's hired to read that and to sort of, you know, to play that part in her film.
In her film, sort of.
Yeah, so I think that was all quite clever, really.
Yeah, very. I must admit, you know, I have an issue with that sort of awkward comedy. You know, that sort of stuff. Where,
well, it's The Office, isn't it?
It's that sort of thing. Yeah, and I find that, you know, that sort of awkwardness not funny at all, unfortunately. So the beginning part, I was with it for that opening conversation. I thought it was quite amusing. But then, as you say, you know, the meetings with the early meeting with the producer and the stuff where she's sort of breaking into the house and things like that. It's like, okay. It wasn't until she meets up with Chase again and gives him the bagel.
Bagel.
Yeah.
Which was hilarious. He's like, oh, I took all the sesame seeds off because I know you don't like them. He's like, no, I'm allergic to sesame seeds. Oh, I thought you just didn't like them. Idiot. It wasn't until that point that it started to really sort of click. And then there was the, you know, when she's in the coffee shop and there's that guy on a first date behind her.
Yeah,
and he's just such a douche.
Oh yeah, yeah.
It's so funny. You know, it's even to the point where he starts saying, "Well, what is it you do?" And she starts telling him, and he just talks over her.
Yeah.
what an ass. So, and then, you know, she looks back to the camera and goes, "He's got to die." And I'm like going, "Yeah, yeah, I think he does."
Yeah.
But yeah. I thought it was very amusing from that point on, you know, sort of the shenanigans she gets up to. It worked really well, I thought. Even though it's, you know, the final meeting with the producers again. I just thought it was so disingenuous where they're sort of sat there going, well, quite frankly, I think you've set the whole women's movement back. I'm thinking, yeah, okay, so a man is telling a woman, you know, where she stands with the women's movement. I was like, okay. Anyway, yeah, so this is it's different. I think that's what we can definitely say. It's definitely a different sort of take on the whole sort of genre of sort of serial killing and all the rest of it. Scores on the doors, Rich.
7 out of 10 from me.
7 out of 10, Steve.
Yeah, I'll go 7.
I'm going to join you on 7. Yep. So as I said, I think the last 2/3 of this worked really well. The first third sort of struggled a bit to get me totally on board. sort of conversation. You know, it's interesting, the stuff like she's very, a very sort of sexual person as well. You know, there's a thing early on where a boyfriend sort of goes, look, are you gonna end up getting naked in this? She's like, no. Well, we end up getting naked everywhere else. So you're probably right. Yeah. So that was, you know, the fact that she's got this, her own sort of sexual agency, was sort of made it quite interesting as well. So yeah, so 3/7 for I Blame Society. Go check it out. Our next film is Fear of Rain. Bipolar teenager Rain is suffering horrific nightmares. While her parents struggle to cope with her condition, Rain suspects that their neighbor has kidnapped a young girl and is keeping her confined in her house. The only person who believes her is another teen called Caleb, but Rain isn't convinced that he's even real. This is quite a long film, guys. It's 109 minutes. Much longer than we would expect for a sort of genre thriller or even a horror movie. And I think that comes down to the fact that this film is dealing with a person with bipolar condition.
Schizophrenia.
Schizophrenia. Yeah. It's taking pains to ensure it develops that side of the story. It's not just a gimmick. It's something they actually want to sort of deal with. So there's probably as much time devoted to that storyline as there is to Caleb and the sort of the possibility of the young girl next door.
Definitely.
So let's chuck it over to Steve to open up with.
I enjoyed this, actually. It was a lot better than I thought it was going to be. I think most of that is down to the performance of, is it Madison Eisman as Rain? I thought she was absolutely phenomenal in this.
She reminded me of Hayden Panettiere.
Me too!
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah, she has got a look of her. Mm. But like you say, it actually goes into... It's not just a gimmick, it is explored, and explored quite truthfully, I think, and quite, well, it's done in a very positive light and such. Mm-hmm. And again, I thought the neighbour next door, Eugene Bondurant, was very good as, you know, it's a teacher who lives next door, which is never a good sign anyway, is it really? But yes, he's quite a very unique look. And apparently she's been signed on for the new Conjuring film.
All right. Yeah.
Doesn't surprise me.
Yeah. She, when I first saw her, I thought she kind of looked like...
Oh, yeah. What's her name?
Yeah, you know what?
She's got a very distinct, very thin, gaunt, you know, tall lady. Very unique look about her.
Yeah, and then obviously about 3/4 of the way there is a twist, which, to be fair, DC coming a mile off. But again, it works well. It's done in a... not a positive way, but it's not done just for shock or... It's done decently, in a decent way. And the beginning as well, the opening scene, was actually quite terrifying in a way as well.
That was really good, yeah.
But, again, it's more of a mellow thriller than an all-out horror. It's more of a, like, I'd say, like a young adult thriller, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
I think that's a fair thing to say, yeah. Because it's about her being a teenager and dealing with this problem, and you know the environment and the school and the fellow classmates and everything, and the whole the horror part of it, of the threat, the perceived threat, and you know what's happening and investigating, and you know, yeah. The, could it alter? Do you remember we covered that film True Crime with Alicia Silverstone?
Yeah, yeah.
It basically goes down that route.
Yeah.
With you know, like the two of them trying to investigate, going up, you know, going to the library, looking up stuff on computers and everything. It does all that kind of stuff, but it is the uncertainty of a psychological state and everything that's the more interesting side of it. And I'm glad that's much more fully developed. But yeah, I mean, it starts out like a full on horror movie with, you know, it does that horror movie thing of almost, it seems like it's in media res.
Mm.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, screaming. It opens with a scream, running in the darkness or whatever. And then, you know, it completely shifts that around completely. And it almost confuses you because you're thinking, well, hang on a minute. It's not in media res, because it's playing with your expectations.
Yeah. Which, yeah, you don't know if it's a memory or anything. Yeah.
It's
very strange.
Yeah.
It's interesting the way that, you know, that side of things plays out. And the film does a good job of sort of mapping out, you know, is she suffering an episode of schizophrenia? And is her own sort of psyche sort of subconsciously sort of playing on her own fears? Or is she perceiving something that's real? And the film does a very good job of walking that sort of tightrope. You know, when she's sort of talking about, yeah, the person's been abducted, and the psychiatrist is sort of saying, yeah, but that could just, you know, it could just be your own fear of being restrained and she has sort of flashbacks of, like, you know, being prodded and probed by doctors and things. You're thinking, well, is it, you know, could it go either way? And then, you know, the fact that she herself doubts whether or not Caleb is actually real, and, you know, how he interacts with her and the environment, and the fact that she's got these, you know, this sort of mental checklist.
Yes.
To check whether or not something's real or not. You know, is she the only one reacting to it, for example, or, you know, are other people reacting to him and things like that? So, yeah, it was very well planned out, I found.
Yeah, and I like the way that's, because that comes in right at the start, the checklist thing. Because again, you're not sure where you stand with it when it's being introduced, but it's scrawled on the screen. Like a subtitle, but sort of graphically appearing on the screen, and then it comes at various points, which I thought that was lovely. There was this, it looks like a normal, you know, your standard Hollywood thriller, but it's got these really nice little unique stylistic touches. So, for example, there's a really subtle visual effect when she's in the canteen, you know, lunchroom, sorry, and she bumps into the teacher, and there's just like this fraction of a second kind of moment where, you know, she sees something ghastly, but it's her imagination that's causing that. And there's a transition, I think, early in the movie where she is being pulled. I think it's when she's coming out of being pulled away from the ground, and then it's, and, you know, it transitions to her actually being in the hospital, something which reminded me of something from The Doorman we watched a while back, you know, where she's being thrown by the force, and then it transitions to her falling into bed because you know, something like that. The memory.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And there's Katherine Heigl as well is top credited, but she's not really in it very much. There's a bit of a... that's a bit misleading. She should have got an and credit or something, really.
Yeah.
But there's also Harry Connick Jr. Who's I didn't recognize him at first because it's been a few years. You know, he was all over the place in, you know, was it Independence Day he turned up in?
Yes,
and,
he was.
And Copycat and stuff like that. But I haven't actually seen him in an acting role for quite some time. But as soon as I saw, you know, recognized him, I was like, oh yeah, of course. And he was really good, actually. I thought he's developed a very good acting career, I think.
Yeah, because the way you perceive his character in the film sort of changes, you know, as we mentioned, there's this sort of plot twist sort of late in the film.
Hmm.
And, you know, his whole demeanor at first, you know, is suddenly put into sort of stark relief with this twist, and you sort of realize what he's actually been reacting to. I think the film warrants a rewatch, you know, once you sort of understand what's actually happening, just to sort of see how it actually sort of plays out again and sort of see it from that sort of perspective.
Mm. Yeah.
Oh. Any other thoughts on this one?
I would say that, you know, the whole the neighbor, you know, something is something dodgy happening with the neighbor. I mean, that's quite a well, that's a familiar plot, you know, that's Rear Window, it's Mimicry,
Fright Night,
The Burbs.
The Burbs, exactly. Yeah. I was just going to say that, and Disturbia more recently, and all sorts of other ones.
Yeah.
But so, yeah, I don't know if I don't really see that as a criticism, but it is a bit well worn. So the whole investigation thing, it a lot of what it does, you've seen done a million times. But the way they play with the schizophrenia, I think, is the sort of real reason to see it, the way that's developed and presented. I think that gives it that unique dimension.
Absolutely. Okay, definitely. So scores on the doors for Fear of Rain. Richard?
It's another 7 for me.
Okay, and Steve?
Yeah, I'll go 7 on this one.
Yeah, I'll give it a 7 as well. Definitely worth checking out. Fear of Rain. Our next review is The Devil's Machine. Antique expert Brendan Cole is sent to authenticate a 300-year-old clockwork doll with notorious history, also known as the Infernal Princess. In the remote Scottish mansion where it was discovered, Brendan must replicate the 5 tasks that the doll was commanded to perform. However, both he and his girlfriend Rose find themselves drawn into a supernatural event which neither may escape. Now, Rich, this is when we were sort of like working out who'd seen what this week, you dropped me a line. You said, well, there's one particular film I want to make sure that you've seen, which was this one.
It was this one, yeah.
Why, Rich?
Why? Well, because out of all the films that I know we haven't got to the others yet, but out of all the films that we've watched this week, I found this to be the most interesting. Yeah, I thought I was really quite taken with it, and I thought, being a fan of like Hammer Horror and stuff, that you would similarly have quite a lot to say about it.
You're not far wrong. You're not far wrong. Although I have to say that the opening scenes didn't put me in good stead. We have this, you know, the setting's brilliant. So we're in the Highlands in Scotland, you know, during a sort of tumultuous period, kind of like sort of kidnapped sort of period, you know, Bonnie Prince Charlie and all that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've got this regiment of Scottish soldiers carrying this mysterious crate across the border into England where they're going to bury it. And suddenly this English platoon turns up saying, no, you're not going to do that. Unfortunately, the actor, the British guy, I felt really sorry for him, you know, because he's given this, right, we want you to sort of act really manic and give this sort of really horrible cackling laugh. And it's like, oh, God. No, this is painful to watch.
Well, see, I didn't mind that. It was a sort of a madness kind of thing. I thought it worked all right.
Overall, I think this was a case of a brilliant concept, slightly overshadowed. I think they sort of kind of bit off more than they could chew.
It's definitely ambitious. I mean, it's very ambitious.
It's very ambitious. A lot of it does work, I have to say. A lot of this, you know, I didn't find myself fast-forwarding through any of this at all. You know, nothing was boring here. The concept of this doll and the history behind it was really well thought out. The actress playing the doll itself, I thought she was really good, you know, sort of her movements and things.
Yeah, absolutely incredible. The mechanical way that she was moving and the way it was tied in with the sound design and stuff was
absolutely
fantastic. Yeah.
There's a lot going on here. You know, we get these sort of bizarre dream sequences going on. You know, it's not just it's not just
Brendan.
Brendan, who's being affected. It's Rose as well. And it kind of reminded me of the Marquis de Sade sequence in Waxwork.
Yeah. Okay. Well, there's definitely a sort of a Marquis de Sade sort of flavor to this.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, well, even sort of incestuous sort of element to it as well, isn't there? It's a case of like no one's good enough to be my daughter's husband, or you know, that there's a lot of that sort of to it as well.
Although they go to specific pains at the start with some awkward dialogue to say stepfather.
I must have missed that, but yeah, there's definitely a sort of you know, so you mentioned Hammer Horror, sort of, you know, Witchfinder general kind of thing going on as well. You know, it's a lot of good sort of period schlock sort of put into this, I think.
Yeah, and it's set in a sort of sort of country estate sort of place. But it's kind of out of time, the film, because it's modern day, but it feels very old-fashioned, and
it,
you know,
it doesn't have the idiosyncrasies you'd expect.
You know? No, it feels like an old. It feels like it's something taking place in a much more sort of a bygone time. Mm. But they do specify, you know, the locations and things that whatever in the earlier part of the film, and the way they're dressing and stuff sets it as something that's happening pretty much nowadays.
Yeah.
If not immediately now, I can't remember exactly, but the I don't know if like mobile phones and that were a feature. I can't remember, but it's definitely a contemporary story that's got that kind of timeless sort of throwback kind of feel to it, which again, I think is something that Hammer did themselves. They did like stories that were, that, you know, those gothic stories that were more, did they do stuff that was more, you know, contemporary but still feeling like it was old-fashioned? Or am I misremembering?
Well, there are things like Dracula AD 72 and Scars of Dracula, I think it was. Satanic Rites of Dracula was the other one, which is sort of modern.
I was just going back to what you were saying about the opening.
Yeah.
Which I liked, actually. I did enjoy the opening. Mm. It reminded me of the I think it was the Rise of the Mask short, you know, where they're trying to, they've got the case, it's got the mask in it, they've got to bury it, but the influence of it starts to get to them, and then they start fighting and stuff. But what I couldn't figure out from watching the rest of the film is how does that opening relate? Because I was thinking the Infernal Princess doll couldn't have been in the case because it seemed like it was too small. So, which makes me wonder, what was it?
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, now you mention it, and I'm thinking about it, it's like, it's almost like two different films. It's like, okay, so there's like an evil thing which they're transporting in the case to be buried on the hallowed ground, or so, you know, over the border, chuck it over the wall, glad soul. It's their problem now, but then at the same time there's the clockwork, you know, the Infernal Princess herself.
Because I was wondering, is whatever was in the case, could that have been used in the construction of the doll? That would have made sense to me, but I think either it wasn't articulated well or I didn't catch it, but there just seemed a real, in retrospect when I was watching the film, I just kept thinking, well, how does that opening sequence relate? I mean, apart from obviously the madness and everything, but it seems to be two different things, which was unfortunate for my experience of it, because the rest, you know, if you didn't have that opening, I wouldn't have that problem.
No, if it went straight into Brandon and his girlfriend being briefed, you know, and enticed to come up to Scotland, that would have...
You mean his stepdaughter?
Is it a stepdaughter? I thought it was his girlfriend.
What, Rose?
Yeah.
No.
That'll explain why there was... Yeah, that explains sort of the chasteness of their relationship.
Well, that's why it's the father-daughter thing, but it's
bloody stepdaughter. Oh, God.
That's why it's all a bit creepy. I mean, it would have been creepier if it was, you know, they weren't they were actually related, but yeah, because they never actually specify what happened to his wife, her mother. That's I don't think that's ever brought up. So whether I don't know, or quite maybe there's something missing. I don't know, but yeah, they do. There's a bit of dialogue at the very beginning,
right?
Which, oh dear stepfather, you know, kind of thing. It's like, right, okay, so we know we've established your relationship. And
obviously I wasn't paying attention early on after the opening, but anyway, moving on. So, okay, so that explains a lot. So I think one of the film's major strengths and also major weaknesses is the fact that it's shot on location in this, you know, period mansion somewhere. I think it was a couple of locations actually used.
Yeah, it's a National Trust place in Scotland, yeah. I think.
So you know, obviously, you know, the authentic sort of look of the place is great, but I think shooting there had certain restrictions. There's a lot of scenes which are shot from a distance, with no cuts, no sort of close-ups or anything. And I think it was, you know, a mixture of sort of time and what they could actually physically do in these particular rooms. You know, I can imagine there's probably a National Trust person looking over their shoulder going, no, don't do that sort of thing.
Careful. Yeah, don't exactly. Knock anything over.
Exactly. Careful, no. You know, stay behind the rope. the rope line. So I think, yeah, on the one hand, yes, great that you can actually use these places and looks great. You know, really does the production value a world of good. But at the same time, it was quite noticeable that there was a lot of dialogue scenes with no cuts, no sort of close-ups or anything. It was just all shot at a distance. And that actually reminded me of the way that a lot of Caligula was shot by Tinto Brass, you know, back in the day. It's sort of like, look at my brilliant sets. You know, the actors are meaningless in the middle of it. I don't have a lot more to say about this. I enjoyed the atmosphere. I enjoyed the whole mystery of the doll and the backstory of her sort of father-in-law and the way that he was starting to influence the present as well. Thought it all worked really well.
Yeah, kind of crossover between, you know, they're kind of transported, aren't they, in these sort of fantasy sort of some of it's dreams, some of it's actually happening. It's all that sort of uncertainty of where you're at. The film is as the story progresses, it's bathed in a lot of light, you know, like red lighting and blue lighting.
Yeah, there's a lot of day for night photography as well.
Yeah, and the whole, I mean, there's lots of influences on display here, one of which would be The Shining. There's a whole, you know, the whole thing about Brandon sort of starting to lose his mind is, you know, very much Jack. Not to the extent of Jack Nicholson, you know, here's Johnny, or there's nothing like that. But, you know, he's definitely not behaving like himself is what I mean. Going back to the Infernal Princess. So who plays the Infernal Princess? Because I can't remember what her name was.
It was Alexander Hume.
Alexander Hume. Yeah, okay. Talia. Okay. So there's a scene where the doll dances. And it all happened, going back to what you were just saying about, you know, scenes tending to be shot like all in one go or whatever. This is like a one shot dance sequence. You know, the camera doesn't really move; it just stays still and what looks at her dancing, and it's tied in with the mechanical sounds of the movie. I thought it was just fantastic, fantastic. You know, sequence. Really, tremendously impressive. The original title of the film was Automata. Mm-hmm. Which I can kind of understand why it was changed, but I don't think The Devil's Machine is a good title for this. It doesn't fit.
Yeah,
at all. It sort of conjures up something else completely. What I think they should have called it was The Infernal Princess. I think that would have been a much more unique and catchy kind of title that relates specifically to what you're watching. This is the first film I've come across. I think it's their fourth production, from a company called Hex Studios. And director Laurie Brewster. Hadn't come across them before. This is clear. This is like the biggest sort of, I think it's like, you know, they're a small company, independent, crowdfunding, all that sort of stuff. You know, they're really on, you know, I think they're on the basis of this. So I'm, you know, I've said this a few times in episodes recently, but, you know, on the basis of what I've seen here, I'm very interested to see what they're able to do next in the future. And I'd even actually like to go back and look at some of their back catalog.
Definitely
part of their progression, because there's definitely a lot of talent involved here. You know, this is a very low budget film, complete cast of unknowns. You know, filming on location, which isn't easy. You know, there's lots of actors and extras, and you know, the scene at the beginning. You know, it's a very ambitious.
That's sequence. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So I'd say that, and also the stylistic type and the cinematography. I thought they did a really good job. So yeah, this isn't the. It's funny because this isn't the kind of film that I would normally be drawn to, but I just thought there's something really special about this one.
Yeah, I have to agree with you. Yeah, even though I had misgivings at the beginning, this did draw me in. You know, the whole mystery of the infernal princess, I thought it worked really well.
Mm.
So, Rich, how are you going to score it?
I'm going to give this one an 8 out of 10.
We're going to give it a 7, as I said. Didn't work for me at the beginning, but it did get to me eventually. So a 7 and 8 for The Devil's Machine. Check it out. Our next review is Forget Everything and Run. Following an epidemic which turned most of the population into infected flesh-eating mutants, a small family battles against the harsh winter, marauding infected flesh-eating mutants and other desperate humans. I think the film is sort of makes great pains to sort of suggest that no, these aren't zombies, they're sort of people who've just been infected and you know, marauding around the place.
I in a feral blame system. Danny Boyle.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's all his fault, mate. I struggled with this one, to be honest. I found it to be one of those sort of zombie movies which doesn't allow you to have fun. You know, this is sort of like this is the opposite of the sort of person going, yeah, zombie apocalypse. This is the sort of like, yeah, but you know, your food's going to run out. You're going to be freezing. You won't be able to have a campfire because it's just going to attract all the zombies and everything. You're going to be dead in a week. That's the attitude of this film, basically. You know,
it's very bleak.
It's one of the bleak ones, but even so, you know, it does have its moments. One of the things I did like about this is the fact that the father figure, he just totally misjudges his son. Everything he comes out with about his son turns out to be completely wrong. You know, his judgment calls are just so off base, and you know, he's just proven wrong time and time again, which I thought was quite amusing. The other interesting part is, you know, with the marauders, and they're using like other people they've captured as sort of bulletproof vests, basically, which is an interesting touch. I hadn't seen that done before. But Steve, what did you make of Forget Everything and Run?
I loved it. I thought this was absolutely cracking. It's one of them where they've kind of thrown everything, including the kitchen sink, in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've got like that home invasion, zombies, apocalypse, like you said, the harsh winter, but it sticks. And what did it for me was you get a couple of scenes showing, you know, flashbacks to the family before everything went to shit.
Yeah.
And to me, it just gave enough character development that you actually cared about the family. And I really enjoyed it. I agree with you. The only thing I didn't like was the son. He was the softest, annoying brat I've seen for a while. And like you say, everything that he should be doing, he hesitates and causes more issues for the family. And until the ending where he finally, you know, like mans up and actually does something, then fair, then, you know. And also you've got the daughter ill in bed, you know, trying to be sedated or, you know, on life support or whatever it is. And I really enjoyed it. And then the Marauders turn up and then it just gives it this whole other twist, you know, going back to their camp and coming back. And I really enjoyed it. I thought it was really well shot. it wasn't, I didn't really see any CGI in there as such. It wasn't over-reliant on that. I think it was quite all done quite practically. And yeah, I actually really enjoyed this.
Cool. Rich?
Yeah, it took a while for me to get into, and it was one of the ones that I probably got the least out of the, well, no, that's not true. It's to an extent. I mean, it starts off you're thrown into that sort of end of the world apocalypse sort of scenario. You know, it's as I was listening to something earlier, and they were saying, you know, there's two kinds of I think it was Adkins Undisputed, actually, I was talking about re-kill. And the host Mike was saying about there's two types of zombie movies. There's the one where the apocalypse is just happening, you know, the virus or the bite or whatever, it's all just kicking off. And then there's the one where it's 28 days later, it's somewhere down the line. And this is very much of, this is definitely, you know, influenced by 28 days later in a lot of ways. But this is a much more, more of a single location, not entirely single location because there's a couple of others, but the majority of the film takes place in the house where this family have taken refuge, the latest point in their journey where they've sort of hunkered down. And the production design is amazing on the house. I mean, it looks really worn and ragged. There's interesting graffiti and stuff scrawled all over the place. There's a lot for the eye to take in, and it's a very well shot film as well. But it's this family, it's the sort of the people they encounter. So that's where, you know, you've got the tension, you've got the human drama from the people, you know, humans trying to do one over on each other to stay alive, which is what the whole setup is when you got the introductory quote from the female lead in the movie. There's sort of a quote that's attributed to her at the start. And it reminded me a lot of, I know it's different in terms of the scale of the story and stuff, but it's Rose from a while back, which
I got that as well.
Yep.
You know, that was all takes place in a home where they've hunkered down. They're sort of hoping for a cure or something for what ails. And so that's why they can't really move around too much. And then somebody else comes into the situation. So there's a lot that's similar, a lot of familiarity. And also we've seen zombie movies where, you know, there's a bunch of survivors and, you know, that's infighting and whatnot. So that it's a bit different that we focus more on a strong family unit. But it's fleshed out with these flashbacks, which I thought was quite well played. After a few intense scenes at the beginning, we go back to what seems to be a first meeting between the guy and the male and the female lead. And they look so different. That's another good thing. You know, it's not just the production design. It's like costume design and the makeup and everything, because, you know, he's grown a beard and everything, and, you know, they're very worn, you know, they've got cuts and whatnot on them. So it goes back to what seems to be their first meeting, but it's actually not. They're just sort of being playful. And there's a news, you know, the obligatory news broadcast of, oh, something seems to have happened, but then it's not really dwelt upon. And, you know, the story unfolds and there's different bits and bobs. And is it just something that's affecting this area of the mountains, which is what they're all being led to believe? Or is it something that's gone a bit broader? So there's scope. And, you know, they could develop the story and, you know, go off in sequels or whatever if they wanted to. Now, one thing I couldn't really get was why it was called Forget Everything and Run.
Yeah.
I had this, you know, I was saying a minute ago about The Devil's Machine that I didn't think the title fitted. Well, here they don't forget everything and run, do they, really? Yeah. they basically,
it's the one thing,
stay where they are.
Yeah.
So the film was originally called Fear, and what forget everything and run makes up the word fear. Well, I don't know if that's an afterthought, but if we go back and watch the original trailer or the original poster for the film, it's just fear. They don't even use the forget everything and run bit. So that's quite interesting.
Yeah. Well,
but fear itself is sort of, sorry.
So there's another quote at the end, isn't there, where they sort of say, well, you can either be forget everything and run, or
yes,
sort of fight.
Yeah. Mm. What are the two, definitions that they sort of break down as it. And I suppose that's how they've tried to tie it in. But the film comes up with forget everything and run at the front. And also the letters are coloured. So fear is like the other title, but the film is being marketed more or listed as, if you try to look it up anywhere, you'll probably... Because we were talking about previously, you know, off air about the difficulty trying to find some information on the film, because Forget Everything and Run isn't listed on IMDb. You have to look it up as F.E.A.R. So that's just sort of a retitling confusion thing. But I don't think that's a great title. Fear, I don't think it's a great title. So.
Yeah.
I think damned if you do and damned if you don't with that one. But so performance is very strong. Mention who the... So we had Marcy Miller as the lead character, Jo Alistair. She was great. And the husband as well.
Jason Tobias.
Yeah, Jason Tobias. He was... And he's the... I think he's the co-director.
Oh,
yeah.
And writer. Co-writer as well.
Yeah. Yeah. So he's co-directed this with Jeff Reisner, mm-hmm. who is... I was also a cinematographer as well. Has done one called Jurassic Wars. And what's this other one? It's a Star Wars fan film. I've just seen him linked to Rebellion, a Star Wars story. I'm not sure if I've seen that one, but I'll definitely look it up just in case. But so there's good stuff in here. Oh, and the mean old lady who comes in, you know, she's really good. And, you know, there's that old we're not so different, you and me kind of thing between those characters, which I thought was nice. And there's a bit where the guy goes to... I think he has to take her, he's taken by her son back to their camp because he wanted to get stuff and things will go a bit funny there. And that. So, there's a lot of good stuff in here, but it wasn't one of my favorites that I've seen, to be honest. But I think, you know, if you like zombie movies, even though this is one of those zombie movies where they don't call them zombies, which are, you know, there's quite a lot of them like that these days. I think even The Walking Dead, I heard that they don't actually call them zombies.
Never referred them as zombies.
Never.
No.
No.
So, I think if you like all this sort of stuff, I think you're going to get something out of it. Definitely.
Cool. All right, then. Scores on the doors, guys. See?
I'm going to give it an 8.
An 8? Nice. Rich?
So I'm going to go a bit lower. I'm going to go a 6 on this one.
Okay, I'm joining you on a 6. If you are a fan of this, I heartily suggest you check out sort of the British version of this, minus the zombies, called Edge of Extinction. Sort of similar sort of budget, similar feel to it. And I thought that was actually really good, even though it's a very long film. It's about 2.5 hours.
Which is crazy.
It's crazy. Who makes an indie genre
film that's 2.5 hours long?
Yeah, but it is actually really good. And definitely sort of fits in with this sort of, this sort of bleak outlook for post-apocalypse. So, yes, I'm giving it a 6. Rich has given it 6. And Steve really liked this one. Gave it an 8. Go check it out. Our next review is For the Sake of Vicious. On the night of Halloween, an overworked nurse called Romina returns home to find two people in her house, one unconscious and the other crazy. And that's just the start of the most harrowing night of her life. I'm going to keep my powder dry for the time being, so I'm going to throw this over to Rich.
You know, a while back we watched that film Julia X.
Yes.
Yes.
This is like Julia X all over again, a bit for me, because I didn't get on with this too much. It's basically a three-hander for the most part between a vengeful father, a suspected rapist, and the nurse who's become involved in it. Now, one of the things that didn't work for me was that I couldn't quite figure out why the nurse was so involved. I think she got involved because he knew her from what happened to his daughter.
She's the one who treated her daughter.
But why does she buy in on his his vengeful mission, his madness, and he's basically trying to kill this guy, or he's trying to force a confession, isn't he? That's what he's trying to do. It's a whole Guantanamo-ish kind of thing. But reasonably she would not be going along with it. And even once she was going along with it, there comes a point in the story where it seemed like she should have tapped out or got out of the situation, and that just didn't work for me. I want to throw it back to you to sort of get your views on that, or Steve.
Right. Let's go to Steve first.
Okay, now to answer your question, Rich, I think what it was is obviously the guy had been let go. He'd been on trial and got off of it.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So she was the original nurse, so she knew the state of the injuries of the daughter.
Mm-hmm.
So I think she's trying to do a Hippocratic Oath because he says to him, keep him alive. Mm-hmm. I don't want him at the beginning. He's beat him up too much. He wants him alive to get the confession.
Mm-hmm.
So she helps him to keep him alive. And obviously, I think she's obviously disgusted at what's happened to the other guy's daughter.
Yeah, yeah.
Then, and obviously it's a landlord as well.
Mm.
So that's why she's kind of embroiled in it. And I think she doesn't know which way to go. She's like, shit, do I help him out? I want to do him because of what he did. And all that lot. Then it just ramps up into fucking stupid, ridiculous ultra-violence. And it starts off grim, and it gets grimmer and grimmer and grimmer. And I'll be honest, the title is so befitting of this film because it's just vicious for the sake of being vicious. And I didn't get on with it at all, to be fair.
I'm not surprised because I know you're not particularly fond of sort of the more sort of gory sort of things. And this film is just like packed full of some of the goriest kills you're likely to see. So it probably comes as no surprise that I fucking love this film.
I was thinking you're gonna say that you like, because I was like, I didn't like Julia X. I was thinking we're going to have another Julia X conversation.
I love this film.
But did it make, I didn't think it made any sense.
Well, I mean, no. I'll see if I can help you unpack it a little bit.
Okay, so. I just want to mention one particular scene. So we see the victim. Mm-hmm. Well, there's a flashback scene where he's at home and he says goodbye to his kids and he goes outside and he talks to the guys and there's the bloke with the motorcycle helmet and stuff.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And that's kind of, that doesn't go anywhere. That scene doesn't, it doesn't get elaborated or whatever. It's just like, why was that scene there?
What that scene does is show that there is a darker side to this character, basically. You know, for all his protestations of his innocence and, you know, you got the wrong guy, that, you know, the courts prove me innocent and all the rest of it, there's something going on with this guy. You know, he berates these guys for being outside his house. You know, what the fuck are you doing outside my house, sort of thing. You know, keep it.
Yeah, it should be at the office.
Distance, you know, the office, that sort of thing. So yeah, there's, you know, there is definitely something going on. And I think the idea is to sort of wrong foot you a little bit into thinking, yeah, he's guilty because, you know, this sort of association. And then, of course, when we do meet these guys later on, there's that expectation that you know, of why they are there. So I kind of disagree with what you're saying about Romina's character. You know, why is she going along with it? She isn't going along with it, I don't think. You know, she's stuck in the house with these two people. It's her house at the end of the day. The guy's confiscated her phone. She can't actually call the police or anything.
But there's a point where they go outside and they're like talking in front of the neighbours and everything.
But by that time, you know, I think... She's reasoning with the guy, you know. She's hearing him out, his side of the story. He's not threatening her, as such. It's a bad situation that she's sort of stuck in. She's doing her best to de-escalate it, to the point where, you know, she does actually sort of cut him loose, so he can make his phone call, which brings about the second half of the film. So I think, and there's this other bit as well, when you find out that, you know, the guy tied to the chair had actually been sleeping with the other guy's wife, you know, which puts that other spin on it. It's like saying, well, of course you're accusing him of this heinous crime. You know, you want revenge for your wife's infidelity on top of everything else. So that, you know, there are these sort of interesting facets to it. There's not a lot of plot, really. No. But it does give you enough to sort of throw what you're being faced with into doubt, you know.
Well, that's what I thought. I mean, it's like the plot is very simple, but at the same time, very complicated. Because there's the whole bit where the second part, you know, where the motorcycle helmet guy and that all come at the house. I don't think it's, for me, it was like, it wasn't articulated why that would even be happening. You know, you know, it seemed like it should be more of a rescue mission than anything.
Expecting. But when he finally does sort of speak to sort of the cigarette smoking guy, shall we call him? He says why, and he just says, I want everything. And it's like, yeah, it's a power play, basically.
Yeah, it's a power play, yeah. I just don't think that was articulated. I think it could have been
It could have, clearer. But also, as well, there's that bit where you find out who actually did do the rape of the daughter, if you know what I mean. And even that, like Rich is saying, I don't think that was articulated very well. To be fair, it's just one line.
Yeah, it's one line.
It could easily be missed.
It could have, yeah. Except when she confronts him with the medical report at the end, and you can tell by his face, you know, he's not denying it or anything. There's a sort of grim acceptance of his fate, kind of thing. And she, you know, it's like she knows that he knows, you know, that he did it, sort of thing. I was on board with that, basically. A few interesting things. I mean, you know, we talk about the gore. This film is a gory film. There's not a lot of guns in it. There's a lot of knives. There's a lot of claw hammers. You know, there's some.
There's a lot of very resilient characters.
Oh, some very nasty stuff. You know, nobody comes out of this clean or unscathed.
The sound design.
The sound design is brilliant.
It was great. Yeah.
There's a particular. All that. And there's a particular sound right at the end.
Yeah.
Which is something like a coffee mug breaking. Mm. And, you know, once you hear it, it'll stick with you for a while. You know, you don't see what it is, but you hear it and you know what it was. And it's fucking grim.
Basically. Did you watch it on headphones?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, same here.
I mean, one of the refreshing things about this, a couple of things. One is the fact that there's no in media res, even though I thought there was right at the beginning.
Yeah, yeah, I do as well. Yeah,
because the film just starts, you know, with this scene, you know, with the main character, one of the main characters standing over a bunch of bodies, and I thought, oh, here we go, okay, fucking in media res. But no, it turned out that that wasn't the case. This is actually what the starting point of the story. And even though it's not a flash forward, it still serves as a sort of warning of what we're going to get sort of later on in the film without actually sort of like showing us. The other thing is the fact that Romina's house is just a normal house. You know, it's a two bedroom, maybe three bedroom at the most, standard house as we'd find in England. I mean, the film's Canadian, so I don't know if their house is a bit smaller, but it made everything really interesting. So a lot of the things that happen in the house are done in close up because, you know, when you got like five people in a box room, and one of them's having to sort of film it all, it makes it sort of very difficult. You know, fixes and fittings are getting smashed up by default rather than design because they're just in the way for all these people, which just made it really, really interesting, different. I really loved this film. It was a shock. But there came a point where I had to hit the pause button and just leave the room, go downstairs, make a cup of coffee, get my breath back, you know, because it was just so tense and so violent what was going on screen. But, you know, it's just like, no, I need a break before getting back into it because it just does not let up at all. You know, it gets to a point where they've killed like three or four people and the cigarette smoking man just gets on the phone and calls up another three or four people to come and sort of do his bidding. It's amazing.
Yeah, didn't do anything for me.
No, I mean, I
even wrote down, similar to what Steve was saying, I wrote down title apt, as there is a lot of viciousness just for the sake of it. I couldn't really.
It's vicious.
It is, and it's an hour and, you know, you take off the end credits, it's about an hour and 15 minutes long.
It's pretty tight.
I think I would have probably appreciated a bit more embellishment, to be honest. To connect with it a bit more. What I've found interesting was this is another co-directed film. And the previous films from both of the directors who worked independently of each other, I believe, before. One of them is on my, it's actually been on my watch list for a while, called The Demolisher. Both these films I'm going to mention, they're on Amazon Prime. The Demolisher, which is like a vigilante movie, which I've been quite intrigued about. And the other one, the other director, so that one was done by Gabriel Carrere. And this one is by Reese Evanescence, called Defective. I don't know if you remember. I think we looked at the trailer a long time ago. Sci-fi movie. That's on Prime now. So although I didn't like this, I am going to go and check out these other two movies that they've done, which look very, you know, very different kind of propositions in those. But because, you know, regardless of how I feel about this particular film, there do seem to be, you know, interesting, you know, they're interesting filmmakers from what I can tell, even though I didn't like this particular production.
Okay. Scores on the doors then, Rich.
I'm going to give this a 4.
And Steve?
Yeah, 4.
A 4, oh my God.
It's a 4 because it's poor.
I'm guys. Yeah. I, this is my favorite film of the year so far. I'm giving this a 9 out of 10.
What?
I'm giving this
okay, fair enough. 9 out of 10.
Yeah, it's my favorite watch of the year so far.
See, this is what I love about our discussions and stuff like this. You know, it's like, whoa, that's incredible. Well, I'm glad it worked for you.
It really did.
Just goes to say.
My only niggle is the soundtrack was a little bit too intrusive at times. You know, they could have done with just sort of paring it back a little bit. It was just a bit sort of overemphasizing certain scenes. But other than that, and the fact there's no bloody Blu-ray release, it's going straight to DVD.
Oh, especially with the cinematography, you know, this would lend itself to that sort of sharp, colourful, high definition track. Now, the poster, the original poster and the new the UK release poster highlights this motorcycle helmet.
Mm. Guy. Yeah,
he's actually not in it very much. Not much.
But people know.
He's sort of like a featured henchman, basically, who comes in and. Has a couple of scenes, essentially.
Yeah. I mean, that whole bit I absolutely loved when they're hiding upstairs and he's creeping along the landing, and because it's an old house, you know, you can hear the floorboards creaking, so they know exactly where he is, you know, and he doesn't know where they are, but he's sort of guessing, and then this sort of, you know, all kicks off. I thought that was just so well done. Really liked this.
Well, I've just had a read up on IMDb, and apparently it actually was a house that was due for demolition.
But IMDb, there is some interesting elements in there as well. They do mention there was some other scenes. Originally, it was going to be more, you know, stuff with the basement as well. There's going to be a whole, you know, scenes set in the basement, which is originally where they're going to tie the guy up. And there's a backstory for Romina having been attacked herself in the past, and not wanting to go down into the basement because it had certain connotations. So, yeah, it's a lot of interesting bits they could have done. I'm kind of glad they didn't. I like the sort of, you know, the streamlined, very lean sort of storytelling that they've ended up with. So, you know, it's kind of like Reservoir Dogs, you know, sort of sometimes it's just out of necessity they end up with sort of a more sort of streamlined story than what the pretty would have had. But yeah, I thoroughly like this. Pity you guys didn't. I kind of knew, I knew Steve wouldn't, because it's just so gory and nasty at times. So I knew that was going to be a turn off. But I was surprised. I can kind of see where you're coming from with the Julia X comparison, especially with the sort of trashing of the house element.
Well, it is the same plot. It's that I think you're, you know, a baddie who deserves to be punished. So therefore, I'm going to punish you. And obviously, there's a twist in that particular story. But the setup is basically exactly the same, except instead of Kevin Sorbo, we've got this guy with that very distinctive haircut.
Anyway, so 2 4s and a 9 for the sake of Vicious. Check it out. Our short shot this week is Meet Jimmy. In a late night laundromat, a young woman called Jennifer listens to the latest episode of her favorite true crime podcast, which has an audio recording of a notorious serial killer. However, as she listens, it seems that the recording might be speaking directly to her. Let's throw this over to Rich to begin with.
Yeah, I was very impressed with this. It's very atmospheric. I wasn't sure about the you can tell they've made it on a really low budget. I mean, it's all the majority of it takes place in one very small part of a laundromat, so you basically got the spinning drum and the person in close-up sort of listening to their iPod, and for the most part that's as much as you see. The sort of camera moves around a bit in that space, but it's all to do with the lighting and the sound design, and everything is how it all comes together. It's structured, as you say, it's a podcast, so we get to hear the the narrator sort of talking it through. I had a couple of issues with the accent, which was a bit wandering, but in terms of the way it's executed and you know, the way the story, which is just over 6 minutes, unfolds, I thought it was brilliant.
I have to agree. Jessica, I mentioned to you when I've forwarded this on to you, listen to it with your headphones on, mainly because as Richard alluded, I mean, it is all about the sort of the sound design, I think. How did you find this?
Oh, I really enjoyed it. And I was glad that you told me to listen on my headphones because, as you say, it's very much an achievement in sound design primarily, which I enjoy quite a bit. It definitely, I checked over my shoulder quite a few times while watching it. There was an interesting mixture of tones. There was certainly some comedy to it, especially, you know, Jimmy Two Fingers sounding like one of Fat Tony's men from The Simpsons. and some of the, there were some bits that were played for comedy, but I liked that it was kind of poking fun at the current appetite for true crime stories and kind of interrogating why people are so fascinated by them. But I loved the low budget and the use of space and just the close-ups, because everything, Jimmy Two Fingers' MO is to strangle someone by putting his fingers in their mouth. And we get so many close-ups of the main character's throat and her mouth, and it keeps you on the edge of your seat waiting for some kind of bodily harm to come to her, just kind of focusing on these areas of the body that he targets.
Absolutely. I like the there's a sort of weird sort of playfulness with the dialogue as well, which reminded me a bit of like Dr. Seuss in a way. You know, it's things like I forgot what it was now. It's something like he puts two fingers down your throat and makes you vomit till you choke. You know, it's mm-hmm. There's another one as sort of later on. You know. I can't remember what it was, but yeah, there's this sort of playful sort of like almost like rhyming couplets to the dialogue. Steve, did you enjoy this one?
Yeah, I did. excuse me. So, like you say, it was. I watched it on my phone as well with my headphones in, and it really gave that impression of being a podcast, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And like I say, the sound design was great on it, and even the little things like, you know, the blood coming out of the washing machine and things like that, I found it really, really creepy and really atmospheric. And like I say, like Jessica said, there's a couple of bits played for last, but the woman in the other woman in the laundrette, like the, I don't know, the worker or whatever, it kind of reminded me of Doc Cotton in a way, you know.
in
the laundrette, I'm going to fag, you know, it's things like that. I'm presuming that wasn't intentional, but with it being like an American production. But no, it was really good, really creepy. And I think, I don't know about you guys, but I think we all do kind of like a true crime podcast now and again.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
It was enjoyable.
Yeah, things like My Favourite Murder and Lost Podcast on the Left and things like that, yeah.
Golden State Killer one I listened to. Yeah, that was good.
So what was really surprising about this is to learn that it's actually from the Netherlands.
Yeah, it's a Dutch movie.
Yeah. So,
which might explain why the accent.
Well, the accents are a little bit wobbly.
Yeah.
But I thought they did a brilliant job overall. Yeah, absolutely. Anyone got any final thoughts on this before we move on?
I'll just mention that it's only just become available, but it was made in 2018. So the director, David Jan Bronsgeest, has made a few films subsequent to this. So you know, whether they're available or not, I'm not sure, but definitely something I'll be looking up. There's a film called Mr. Lonely recently, and a few others.
Cool.
I felt like this may just be me being biased because I'm a huge fan of 1974's Black Christmas, but I felt like the actor who played Jimmy was kind of channeling Billy in some of his voice acting, which I really appreciated.
Yeah, I can see that. So we put the links to the short shots, to the short films, into the footnotes, so please check it out. Our D2B throwback this week is Satan's Little Helper. On Halloween, an impressionable child called Doug sees an actual masked killer disposing of a body and jumps to the conclusion that this person is actually Satan himself. Volunteering himself as a helper, Doug unwittingly helps him commit more murders until things get a little too close to home. So I'm assuming, Jessica, this is a sort of perennial favorite of yours. Is this a film that comes out every Halloween?
It is, yeah. I actually, appropriately enough, I first found this film at the video store. But I was combing through horror movies and saw this cover with this great demon mask. And the title alone had me sold. So I checked it out and was very pleasantly surprised. I wasn't expecting much. I was hoping it lived up to the title. But yeah, it's definitely one that I revisit often. I rewatched it to talk about it here, but I found that I remembered so much just because I watch it quite a bit. And so it's definitely a favorite of mine.
So I think first off the bat, I think we've got to talk about Amanda Plummer in this, who plays the mum. Is she or is she not the coolest horror mum ever?
I think she is. I really
because
do.
She is so laid back in this film. It doesn't bat an eyelid when her daughter brings back a boy from college, you know, lets her son play sort of gory video games and sort of wears the skimpiest of she gives her daughter her own sort of like slutty outfit from the previous Halloween. God, you can bung that
right
on.
Yeah, she is very in some ways, perhaps a bit too sex positive with regard to her own children, because there's a very unusual subplot where Dougie believes that he and his sister are betrothed. He's eventually going to marry her. He is very jealous of her boyfriend. And Amanda Plummer's character even jokes about, I'm not sure how much they teach him about incest in school, which is troubling, but it fits in with this really off-kilter world that these people all inhabit. Yeah. But yeah, she's the most laid-back mom. She's very, very eager for her daughter to bring the boyfriend home and have him sleep over. And wear the enticing costume.
It's bizarre. Usually the mums are like, you're not going out in that and all the rest of it. And who's he, for God's sake? but yeah, it's interesting. And then we've got sort of Dougie, as you say, who is infatuated with his older sister, sees the new boyfriend as a threat, and sees this sort of Satan character as a way of getting rid of him, which is quite interesting. And it must be really bizarre for this guy, you know, to be found out, first of all, you know, oops, you've got me, you know, I've just murdered this guy, you know, by this kid, and then find out the kid actually wants you to help him murder somebody else. It's like, it's a bizarre sort of world.
I love how much he rolls with it, because clearly the Satan man is getting quite a bit of perverse pleasure out of playing this role and kind of conning this young child into helping him, because he's obviously out to cause as much mayhem as possible. And then when he gets a willing helper, it just plays into his hands in a really delightfully horrifying way.
It's bizarre. So the character of Dougie, I mean, you know, I've read a few sort of things online, and there's a lot of ire sort of targeted towards him. I saw one video review where the guy sort of just laying into him, sort of going, oh, this stupid kid and all the rest of it. But I think he's just at that sort of impressionable age. You know, I mean, my own son he's on the autistic spectrum, and he doesn't quite grasp the concept of sort of death and things like that, you know, the fact that once you're gone, you're gone. And I can sort of see that little bit of that here, you know, the whole thing with the video game, and he can't sort of really discern the difference between reality and fantasy, like when he's been pushed around in the shopping cart and he's, you know, deliberately crashing into old ladies and stuff like that, and go, yeah, 10 points. And it's like, right. Oh my God, you know, you clearly hurt somebody here. And you know, but it's all just a game to him. It's, you know, it's an interesting sort of setup for sure.
Yeah, I think there's an interesting balance with Dougie between him being just likable enough that we care about what's happening, and just unlikable enough that we kind of root for the Satan man a lot, which I think the movie kind of indicts the viewer. But just like Dougie is, you know, taking joy in people being murdered and maimed, and, you know, supposedly the video game is to blame, it's kind of pointing the finger at the viewer, like, well, you're enjoying seeing all these people being murdered and maimed as well. So it's kind of poking fun at horror fans who have a strong appetite for gore and for kills, I think. I don't think it's in a heavy-handed way. It's just really over the top and quite campy at times.
Yeah, certainly. It's an interesting bit as well when the dad turns up sort of like two-thirds of the way in the film, and he's never been mentioned before. It's like, oh, dad's home. I thought, really? I thought you were like a single mum or something at this point. It was very, very strange that he sort of just pops in.
At the very beginning of the movie, Jenna asks where he is, and she says, oh, he's working for the weekend, or maybe he's having an affair, I don't know. So just everything is so strange, and nobody really cares about, you know, where dad's at, or whether my husband is being faithful. It's she just very much goes with the flow.
It's a very bizarre situation.
If I can just interject at this point.
Yeah.
Now, I remember this being a big film for Catherine Winnick, and as I think she's the female lead, but I don't remember the film well enough to know, is she the film's final girl? Does she have a showdown with the killer at the end?
It doesn't really play out like that.
No.
It's got a very different sort of setup.
I seem to remember that what was quite distinctive about it was that a lot of it took place in daylight, in broad daylight.
That's right, yeah.
Yes. Which is really different to most, you know, other, you know, it's like the counterpoint to Halloween, you know, which is all happening at the nighttime.
Mm-hmm. Well, again with Halloween, though, I mean, you know, there are some sort of iconic scenes in that which are set during the daytime. Like the first time that Laurie Strode thinks she sees Michael Myers sort of behind the hedge sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely right. Yeah.
You know, so
I was thinking more in terms of the kills.
Oh, yeah,
and I think Jenna is, initially the viewer thinks she's going to be the final girl just because, you know, she's the young, beautiful character, and she thinks that the Satan man is her boyfriend because Dougie brings him back to the house in a costume. So it kind of sets them up to be a final showdown, but the way it plays out is quite grim at the very end, and I think it takes a surprising turn.
Yeah.
Just to mention that at the time that I saw it, I didn't know who the director was, and I didn't know who the director was until now. I'd always kind of presumed it was like some new young director, but actually it's a veteran director, Jeff Lieberman, who made films like Squirm and Blue Sunshine.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he also wrote The Neverending Story 3.
Good grief. Yeah.
So this is his last feature that he's made to date. You know, I guess he probably won't make any more, but such an interesting sort of it's tackling a a genre that's been kind of done to death and doing something really, you know, kind of original and creative with it, I think, which is quite interesting for somebody of his age to come up, because he wrote it as well.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, it does kind of feel like this a new young director with a fresh idea. So when I found that out, especially because it was his first film as a director, like Remote Control was in 88, and then he made this one. So there was a 17-year lag or 18-year lag there, yeah.
Wow, yeah, it's quite a bit of a gap. anything else you want to say about this one, Jessica?
I think it's very overlooked. It's not a perfect film. I think it has some faults and some moments that are regrettable. But for the most part, I think it's something that is well worth a look. It's very funny, and it's very creepy, and it's got some sharp satire, I think, that's still relevant today. And it's clearly a low budget movie, but that only adds to its charm in my view.
Yeah, absolutely. There are some really interesting bits, and it does sort of play into the whole the celebration of Halloween, and how it's sort of celebrated in the States as well. Even this sort of smallish town, you know, there's a a fancy dress store that, you know, everyone's getting their costumes from and that sort of thing. It was just very interesting. That was the other thing I wanted to mention was about the boyfriend, his sort of subplot with his parents, specifically his dad, which was really interesting as well. You know, it's sort of quite a bit of pathos there, the fact that he, you know, he'd rather sort of spend time with this girl that he hardly knows rather than sort of going home to face his dad, you know, because he's doing a sort of an arts degree or something and his dad thinks that's a, you know, pile of liberal hooey.
And they say that they talk about how his dad is physically abusive. There's an interesting family dynamic in all of the families that we see, because, you know, Jenna and Amanda Plummer as the mother and kind of the absent dad and the strange psychosexual dynamic in their family. Mm. And the beginning of the movie, I believe the mayor of the town, his son is fond of arson and keeps getting in trouble. And it's suggested that the Satan man might be the mayor's son. So there are all these power dynamics and all these odd kind of abusive family dynamics that it's not poking fun at trauma, but it's using it to tell this really morbidly funny story, which I think is interesting.
That thing about the mayor's son as well, I think there's a bit in there of this, it's sort of almost like an urban legend, isn't it? It's like, oh, yes. you've got to beware, you know, such and such will sort of burn your house down or whatever. And they sort of make a point of sort of saying, don't worry, he's behind bars this year. I was really pleasantly surprised by it. I think I'd avoided it before because it sounded like The Simpsons to me. You know, the fact that the dog called Santa's little helper. Right. It's, that sort of kind of reminded me of, and I wasn't sure if it was like just going to be this sort of silly, jokey thing, but it's not. It is a genuine sort of horror film with, you know, an interesting angle to it. You know, the fact this kid's been sort of duped, or he's sort of duped himself basically into sort of thinking this way. But we don't score the short shots, sorry, not the short shots, the DTV throwbacks, but we do recommend them. This is supposedly available on Shudder. If not, you can certainly find a copy on a certain tubing site, shall we say, if you happen to look hard enough, or scour the shelves of CEX or the local gaming shop, and you'll probably find a copy.
It came out on DVD by Third Millennium in 2005, I think. So yeah, there'll be copies floating around, I'm sure. Amazon, but yeah, it's definitely on Shudder.
Yep, definitely worth checking out, for sure, if you haven't seen it already. And that is the end of the show. So just down to me to thank everyone for turning up and talking about our films tonight. So mainly Jessica, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
No problem. Is there any particular thing you want to plug before you go?
Not particularly. I pretty much, my socials is where I plug everything. So I've already covered that, but I appreciate it.
No problem. We Who Walk Here is her Twitter handle. So look her up and check out some of her works. Other than that, check out the DTV Short Shots Twitter handle and the podcast that goes with it, where we look exclusively at short films. And check us out on Twitter and Facebook at the DTV Digest. Thank you for listening and tune in next time.
Thank you for listening to the DTV Digest. Let us know your thoughts in the comments and tune in again next time.